Notenköpfe. Da ist Musik im Gespräch. Ein Rondo-Podcast. Heute für euch da, Chris Lloyd.
The world of orchestras and management is an intriguing one. How often, as listeners, have we ever thought about the people behind the scenes? Those who program hundreds of concerts a year and somehow manage to organize hundreds of musicians from around the world to get on stage together, all whilst battling the all too common issues of financing, relevance to a broader society that doesn't engage as frequently with classical music as they once did, or the ever-changing landscape of the 21st century when it comes to marketing, communication strategies, and social changes that require constant evolution and flexibility. We're coming to you live today from Classical Next in Berlin, the world's leading classical music innovation conference, with over 1,600 delegates from around the world visiting Berlin to discuss all manner of topics around the industry at large. We have conservatoires, record labels, tech startups, independent organizations, international country representatives, managers, festival organizers, booking agents. It's a fantastic event to be around, one that offers a rare opportunity to meet and converse with folks from across the entire spectrum of the classical music industry. Today, I'm joined by two guests who you might say occupy two extreme ends of the orchestral spectrum. The orchestra, as an institute, is relatively new, with the first truly modern orchestras as we know founded in the 1840s with the Vienna and New York Philharmonics. Not that we'd recognize the setup of that orchestra when compared to the modern institutions we're all accustomed to. Orchestras, or large ensembles, have always played a role in classical music, though it was only in the late 19th and early 20th century that they truly became the dominant force that we know now. Ask anyone on the street to define what classical music looks like, and they'll surely picture the maestro in their tailcoat, manically directing the musicians in front of them. Joining me today is Bill Chandler, head of the BBC Symphony Orchestra and Chorus in Britain, and Kelly Lovelady, director and founder of Ruthless Jabberoo, a London-based ensemble dedicated to performing, amongst other things, new works by Australian composers. Founded in 1928, the BBC Symphony and Chorus is perhaps the most recognisable of all the London orchestras, being the principal orchestra of the BBC Proms, which includes performing on the first and last nights of the festival. Over the near 100 years of its existence, they remain active in commissioning and championing new music, with chief conductors throughout history including names such as Sir Adrian Boult, Sir Malcolm Sargent, and Pierre Boulez. As far as institutions go, you'd be hard-pressed to find a more emblematic placeholder in the global community of orchestras. On my other side, Kelly Lovelady was one of the first names I came across when I jumped over the pond from Australia in 2012. Running your own chamber orchestra for well over a decade is no small feat, with the tireless efforts of Lovelady being key to ensuring its continued longevity and success. Perhaps most importantly, Ruthless Jabberoo has always retained its strong, unique selling point and value proposition. That is, being an ensemble of Australasian musicians in Britain and championing new music and social activism. Kelly, let's begin with you. Please, tell us your story and how you came to found this ensemble.
I'm really happy to be talking here today. I have started Ruthless Jabberoo about 14 or so years ago now, which seems amazing because it's definitely evolved over the course of that time. I have always been a self-producing conductor. So it's sort of natural to me that if you want to make work, you need to make the work, be the mover and the shaker. So that is what's been intuitive to me in terms of building a conducting practice. When I came to London, I did end up connecting with the Australian community, the Australian music community over here. And through that community, I realized there was this appetite for playing together. And I thought, there's people here in town that have been, who still identify as Australians in some way, shape or form. And they they do love connecting with other Australians of all generations. So rather than just getting the students together, just getting the early career musicians together, I thought there's a real opportunity to have a sort of a cross-generational ensemble here that is sort of co-enriching members from all backgrounds and also making great work. So, yeah, things have really taken off from there.
Very good. And growing up in Australia, a country that from my lived experience is not one where classical music is the daily dose for most people, how did this form your character when you mentioned building and your approach to music and entrepreneurialism? And how does being in Britain contrast with that?
Yeah, good question. I do think the Australian musical experience from the way I understand it does have a different feeling to the sort of experience, performance, audience experience that I am looking to create these days. I mean, I say that having lived in Australia 30 years ago, 30 years ago, but I'm looking to create a real sort of event-based, reactive, current sensory experience than I'm interested in creating a consumer experience. So, yeah.
Very good. And Bill, welcome. I'd be fascinated to learn your story and how you ended up in Britain as the head of one of its most prestigious ensembles after your experience growing up not in Britain, but in the USA and being a member of the violin department in the Houston Symphony Orchestra.
Yeah, it's a long and twisted story. I hope in an interesting way, and maybe it's slightly unusual for some of compared to some of my colleagues in the orchestra business. I grew up in the Northeastern in America, in the state of Connecticut, and eventually found myself studying violin in Houston at the Shepherd School of Music at Rice University, and then was very lucky to get a job in the violin section there. So for me, that felt like I had achieved all my goals as a starting playing the violin at age six and thinking this is going to be. So I bought a house, I was driving a sports car, I was in my 20s, this was brilliant, you know, and I didn't see any other twists or turns. The road looked pretty straight as far as I was concerned. We were touring around the world, Christoph Eschenbach was a music director, we were making recordings and it felt like the dream, living the dream. But then life has the habit of throwing things at you that you don't see coming. And I met through a mutual friend, the woman who became my wife, who was a flute player in the Royal Scottish National Orchestra. And we, in a short period of time, tried to figure out how we could live in the same place. And eventually I auditioned for a associate concertmaster position in the orchestra. And it all happened within a week. I did a trial, I was offered the job, and I thought, this is fate telling me something. So we moved to Scotland, and we eventually got married, raised three boys there, both living and playing in the same orchestra, and having a fantastic family life in a beautiful country. And it was during this period that, as a musician, it's possible, and I've seen this happen with colleagues, that orchestral musicians can get into a rut of the same thing coming round all the time. And it can become quite repetitive, especially when if you're in an orchestra and you're part of a whole, you're part of and some would say even a cog in the machine. And it became quite clear that actually what we trained to do and what we aspired to be, which was a creative musician throughout all our childhood and studies, etc., didn't necessarily have a great place to sort of express that in an orchestra where you're part of a large team, unless you were motivated yourself to do something about it. So for me, I also created and ran a string quartet for 15 years. And that meant I was involved in planning and programming and negotiating fees and writing copy and presenting and speaking to audiences. And so I learned through this how, in a way, refine my skills around communication. And it became quite clear to me that the reason we are here is to use music to connect people in the world and to sort of banish any feelings of isolation. We are all here together. And music is such a great way to do that. I figured out that I could also do that in the orchestra. So I started doing the pre-concert talks and to the audiences. And then I got involved in the governance of the orchestra, and we are a self hybrid self-governing orchestra. So I became a player director of the orchestra. I was on the board. I was responsible for sitting on panels that hired new chief executives, hired music directors, sat on the finance committee. For 6 years, I was vice chair of the board, so I was running board meetings. So I became quite comfortable and familiar around the overall governance of an organization whilst still playing at the same time. I had great opportunities to lead the orchestra many, many times, recordings, tours, and concerts, Edinburgh Festival, BBC Proms. And leading an orchestra is a kind of a management position also from the first violin chair, where you are the facilitator between the vision of a conductor and the collected psychology of an orchestra, which is a complex thing in and of itself. And so keeping everyone on the same page, on the same route, smoothing out bumps and hiccups, talking to individuals and negotiating around the other principles of the orchestra and keeping an eye on the general behavior of the orchestra, but also the psychology of how an orchestra actually needs to be inspired to play. They will always play and they're professionals and they play well. But the real magic of a conductor and in an artistic situation is to make the musicians want to play for this, for them, and for this sort of combined vision. So there was a lot of skills that I was acquiring there without realizing it that, you know, actually came to serve me a little bit later. It was during my time at RSNO that we had a chief executive who came in and spotted something in me in interactions with on the board and in dealing with things like fundraising and entertaining donors and all the other aspects that come to running a modern orchestra these days. He spotted something that an element of leadership that might blossom in a different way. And so when he asked me to sit on a panel to hire the next director of artistic planning, I actually said, I'd rather do the job myself, if you don't mind. So I went through the process, I applied for the job and I got it. And he held my position open for a year, which was a very generous thing to do in case it didn't work out, or actually I missed playing so much that I didn't want to continue. I never looked back. My violin didn't leave the case for very many times in the last 7 or 8 years, to be honest. And not out of choice, but just because I found this new path so engaging and I got so busy with it. I did that for 5-6 years. And then there was an opportunity to join the BBC as director of the BBC Concert Orchestra, which is where I started. And this was a little bit of a departure in the sense that this is a small, agile orchestra, relatively small, 56 players. That play cross-genre, that play all kinds of really interesting things. And I found myself actually running an orchestra that was backing Stormzy and Ed Sheeran and all kinds of big pop stars, as well as playing at the London Jazz Festival, as well as recording for Call the Midwife soundtrack and doing all kinds of really interesting and I would say fun things to do with an orchestra. And that went on for 2 years. And then this opportunity came to switch over to the BBC Symphony Orchestra. It was a thing I couldn't really pass up. An orchestra with so much legacy, so much history, so much tradition, and, you know, in a way, just a joy to be around this world-class orchestra that makes this most glorious sound. I finished my first BBC Proms season. The orchestra, as you mentioned, plays from the beginning to the end, 12 proms in total. And it's quite a feat for an orchestra to kind of plow through the summer when everyone else is taking a holiday and produce such high quality things in such an iconic venue as the Royal Albert Hall. So, I mean, it's a thrilling thing to be involved with. And I'm now in my second year, looking forward to another prom season coming up very soon. And it's some exciting times ahead.
Beautiful. Thanks very much for that. Now, the pivot from being a professional musician to an administrator is a relatively rare one, with the most famous example in London also being Clive Gillinson, who went from the cello section of the London Symphony Orchestra to essentially rescuing it, I believe, in the 1970s. He's now in charge of Carnegie Hall. How do you enjoy this shift? I mean, you've talked about it there, the shift from making art to the administering of art. Do you ever miss the playing? You said you've never looked back, but do your fingers ever start to itch, especially when you're seeing this music being made?
Yeah, I mean, I have to confess there are times where the music is inside you, and even if you're sitting in the 10th row, I feel it. And there have been moments where I think, oh, I'd love to be in the middle of that. And I think that's the key, actually, that people don't quite realize. And if anyone, Kelly, you'll know this feeling, but if anyone who has never had an opportunity to be on the stage with an orchestra, whether you're playing or not, doesn't really matter, but take that opportunity, because there is something physical about being in the middle of this enormous sound. It comes from the floor. It goes up through your body. It's really hard to describe, except that I just wish everyone could have that experience at least once in their life, because I think it's transformative. Aside from missing the playing, I actually find in a way that I am being even more creative now than I was as a violinist. And I think the reason for that is that I'm able to tell stories in a very different way. We think about storytelling as being fundamental to the art of music. And in this sense, I'm looking for it in a piece of music. I'm looking for the architecture of a piece of music, how a piece of music takes you on a journey. But also in my role and working with my team from the artistic planning department, we can also tell stories within a concert. So one piece to the next, to the next, to the next can also take anyone on a specific journey. And then to take that even on a bigger macro level, we can tell stories across a whole season or around a whole series of festival events or things like that. And it's that, for me, I take enormous pleasure in watching an audience completely absorbed in the magic of this kind of musical storytelling as it goes on. I love the adventure of being an entrepreneur within the business. And I know maybe BBC and entrepreneur doesn't quite maybe obviously go together, but it's a fabulous place to work. There is all these departments within the BBC full of creative people. From the CBBC Children's and Family Department to the Natural History Unit, to all the pop stations, as well as Radio 3 itself, which is what I think is what orchestras are really on this planet for, which is public service, really. And that is what we are, public service broadcaster. So in that sense, having these conversations with creatives across the whole of the universe of the BBC is really quite exciting. And it's almost like open doors everywhere, because everyone wants to make really interesting work all the time. And, with the advantage of the license fee and the subsidy that we enjoy, we're actually freed to sort of create this kind of work in a way that, you know, when I was in charge of the planning of an orchestra outside the BBC, there were more constraints. We always had to keep an eye on the box office. Not to say that we don't at the BBC, we do. We're under enormous commercial pressure. License fee is always, we never take it for granted. And in the world where costs are rising and, governments are strapping down the finances, we don't anticipate that to ever go up. So there's a commercial pressure to everything that we do, even within the BBC all the time. But outside the BBC, it's tough. It's even tougher, I think, in that respect. So I enjoy that challenge. I enjoy the idea of partnership and entrepreneurialism, working with new generations of musicians coming through and developing a pipeline for the future, and also adapting an orchestra, which is kind of, in a way, saddled with tradition. Tradition is part of its appeal for many people, but also its tradition can be a blocker in new ways of thinking and new ways of working. And I think the younger generation coming through, the new musicians that we're working with, either as students or as newly appointed musicians in the orchestra, are beginning to change the way we think. I think expectations are changing and people are beginning to think. I think COVID had a lot to do with this, as young people have become producers themselves and they have expectations about having the space to be creative and to do this. And an orchestra hasn't traditionally been that space. And I think we have a really interesting opportunity to rethink how we create space for people. So we're exploring ways of giving a curation space for musicians within the orchestra to develop their own work. And I really love to see how orchestras adapt this going forward. For you, Kelly, it is the way you've always worked. So in a way, we're learning a trick from our colleagues who operate in a more nimble and agile way. So it'll be exciting to see how orchestras can adapt and create that kind of space for that sort of new way of thinking.
That does bring me next to you, Kelly. As an independent, you understand all of the commercial pressures that Bill's referring to there, and then also all of the entrepreneurial opportunities that running a small, flexible ensemble offers. So you're responsible not only for the bureaucratic side, but also the administration and the performance elements. So question one, how much work exactly does it take to wear these multiple hats? And two, would you change anything? Would you have it any other way, essentially, considering you get to be in charge both of the making and the administering of the music?
These are big questions. But I think I do really relish having creative control of my own path and having the agency to make the sort of work I want to make. I think that's a really powerful and important element to my practice. In terms of having it any other way, I think there are definitely ways that I could adapt my practice to make it easier for me. For example, having more staff, more regular staff. At the moment, I'm working on a project basis. So I work with freelancers. So I bring in freelancers as things get closer to a project. I think things for me really work on a project basis. The things that really stood out to me in your story, Bill, the storytelling across a program is something that's really close to my heart. So I love curating a program that has connections across the trajectory of an event. So that's the real core of my programming philosophy. You know, we see so many programs out in the world. And when I'm speaking generally about the industry, I'm not meaning to cast shade, but just speaking generally, we see programs that link things by titles, link things by these sort of superficial elements. But I'm really interested in creating connections across music with, especially with sound, most of all. So if something has a sort of a textural sound in one piece and then something in another piece reminds me of that, I mean, it's me as an artist, musician, listener, trying to create a listener audience experience. So for me, the curation of the audience experience is really primary to what I'm doing. Another thing that Bill mentioned that spoke to me was this idea of being on the stage. And so that, of course, really resonates with me. So that is also something that I'm working with on a regular basis, working in a more site-specific, capacity, so that we are creating that resonance in the space for everyone in the space. And so working on a project basis with repertoire that works in a specific venue, most often in non-traditional venues because of the nature of the work and the organization and the costs of running an organization like this, but also the artistic side. So it's I would rather do an interesting project in an interesting space that people then remember and hark back to, and they have a sort of a physical memory of later, and creating this sort of spatial element that makes space for the music to exist.
Aside from a brief period in the 1880s, where one entrepreneur in the USA, I've forgotten his name, was able to make a commercially successful orchestral venture, the orchestra as a model is one that was never designed to be financially viable on its own. Having first been supported by the aristocracy in Europe, it has since become either privately funded by philanthropists, such as a lot of the USA orchestras work on, at governments, which is more the continental European model, or as a shared collective ownership, which most of the London orchestras operate on, and the RNSO that you mentioned earlier, Bill. So I have a hypothesis that if you were to go up to any venture capitalist today and pitch a product that required 100 highly skilled practitioners performing to an audience that could never cover their costs, they'd turn you away fairly rapidly. So it seems then that founding an ensemble in the 21st century would require severe strength, determination, and love. And Kelly, what motivates you to keep up your hard work 14 years after founding your own ensemble?
Well, it's definitely not money. That's for sure. I mean, what motivates me is the work. It's the project. It's the trajectory of the idea from its birth through the course of, the resources that it needs to feed and exist, and then bringing it to fruition, seeing it out in the world, and then moving on. It's a real sort of life of a project world that I live in, and you know, then the project finishes, you put it to bed, and then you move on, and it's a brand new project, starts from the beginning again. It is really a roller coaster. I was recently talking to a friend about a new project idea that we're dreaming up, and just had to remind myself that this talking about repertoire, talking about possibilities, that is also the project. You know, that's the, it's not just the planning of the project. The planning of the project is the project. The marketing of the project is the project itself now. So you forget that they're not those parts of the multifaceted side of promoting the project. You can think of it in a business way, but I've come to the realization that those things, they serve the project. They don't just, you know, they don't just promote the experience. Those, like, I'm really interested in putting out long form editorial, for example, that's commissioned by people that are connected. So I tend to create programs that have conceptual side to them, connected to humanitarian subjects, to existing campaigns. I just think if I'm going to be putting the word out there, shouting from the hilltops about my show, I may as well use that platform to bring visibility to ideas that could use that. I mean, my work is, when I talk about activism and activist ideas, I know that that's a real trigger point for people and sounds like a non-neutral way of operating. But actually what I'm trying to do in a really fundamental way is use my performance making practice to create a space for building compassion and empathy and really just openness and connection across humans, and by being specific. So rather than, you know, I said before about programs that connect things by title, I want to work on a much more specific level. I want to talk about a campaign that's existing that helps someone out there in the world, whether or not I'm connected to them. You know, if it's a story that tugs at the heartstrings that could use another eyeball on it, then why not? And it's something that, you know, lights a flame under you, then why not bring that story into our story? And so I'm working on a platform where I'm having a lot of different stories intertwined, you know, the stories of the orchestra members, the stories of the repertoire, the stories of the composers who are mostly, you know, in the room, the stories of this frame that we're creating around the program, the stories of the campaigners who are then working to bring visibility to that campaign. I mean, there's a lot of layers in the work that I do, which makes it complicated often to talk about, but it also means that I can talk about my work in a lot of different ways. And hopefully there's something for everyone to connect with at some level. And then you come into the room, whether or not you've seen any of that material or devoured any of the pre-performance stuff. I mean, things exist as a whole, but they also exist in the moment. So you can also come into the room, hear the music, and then that is a fulfilling and enriching experience for you as well, whether or not you've seen the pre-concert onslaught.
Just returning very briefly to the topic of the finance of an orchestra. Now, so small organizations like Ruthless Jabiru operating on a project by project basis, that someone told me once a fantastic term for sort of the work you and I do in this freelance independent world. The financial model we work on is the self-exploitation model, which really does sum it all up perfectly. So people will expect that, you know, in these orchestras and these small ensembles, that money is always a project by project type of thing. But for Bill, that's not to say that large institutions are immune from the realities of commercial stress and pressure. You mentioned that earlier. So Bill, what are the challenges? I suppose mostly from a financial perspective, because we'll get into everything else a bit later. But what are the challenges that resonate with Kelly's stories here that you faced in your time, both as the head of BBC, Symphony and the Concert Orchestra, and even in the RNSO?
I think the challenges are similar. The context is different. Kelly might describe the fact that sometimes there doesn't feel like there's a safety net under the tightrope you're walking in, whereas I probably do have something to land on at some point. So, I mean, there is a luxury there that I do not take for granted. That safety net isn't there as, I think that safety net is there because someone, and in this case, that someone was John Reith, the original director general of the BBC in the late 20s, who decided that radio was a public service. And radio could change people's lives. And of course it did. And he could have said, no, we're going to have plays and speech and news and that's it. And we're not going to have music. But the early days of the BBC was mostly music and some speech. And there was definitely a vision there that there was, we talk about public service broadcasting, but let's not forget that it's public service is the reason that we're here. And that net is there, just like the welfare net and various other NHS and all these other things that kind of emerged later on after the war and so on, is also a public service. So in a way, our mission is to provide an enriched cultural life to society. And that is what we're engaged to do. Now, I get to play in a similar playground that Kelly does in the sense that we get to have these magic moments where an idea is born. And it usually it's not one person's idea. It's a collective. It's bounced around. Or they always say if you steal from one person, you're plagiarizing. But if you steal from everybody, that's research. And so keeping your eyes open and having this kind of openness, I mean, is really an exciting part of it. And so we do create that. And in a way, we're committed to it because the UK government or over the history of the BBC, which is now over 100 years old, the orchestra approaching its 100th anniversary, was also committed to that. And in a way, the mission of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, along with the BBC itself, in terms of music, is to democratize it. And I think in a way, that's what they did. Prior to the radio, you had to live near a concert hall to hear live music, or unless it was a very small scale, in which case you might play at home, or it might be in church, or it might be somewhere else, historically speaking. But the radio really changed that. So I think one of the things that we give back as a commitment for this subsidy is this mission to serve all of the audiences across the UK. And so the challenge for us is to provide that variety, that super broad menu of various things that means that we maintain this enriching power across all demographics. And we're not always great at that, and audiences come and go in different sizes. But for us, the thrill of a musician seeing an engaged audience is really what drives individual musicians about this. And the fact that I think historically the BBC orchestras might have been more focused on the broadcast outcome and the digital audience, which was the main driving force of it to begin with. Now we actually, and personally, I'm seeing a much more balanced view of what the live event does, because a full hall and a really engaged, fabulous, magical performance in a live concert hall makes great radio. That you can you listen to the radio and you hear the buzz at the proms is a great example, where we've had fortunate to have nearly 100% capacity for all the concerts last year. And for me, these things work together. They're not separate ideas. And we will always be working in an environment where that subsidy is probably not going to get bigger, and costs get higher, and it's gradually shrinking all the time. We're under lots of pressure to sort of replace that money. The more, in a strange way, the more successful we are, the more we prove how independent we might actually be. So it's a fine line about understanding how we serve the public the best we can. But ultimately, however it's financed, the main goal is that connection with an audience, whether it's online or on the radio or in a concert hall or anywhere in a community as well, which is another facet of our work that we're really expanding around. Relevance is going to be key for the future.
That ties quite nicely to the next question I've got for you, Kelly. To preface it, the role of orchestras in societies is a really interesting one, particularly in countries such as Germany, where so much taxpayer money is filtered directly into the performing arts. We could posit that 100 years ago, orchestras had a much larger role in society than they currently occupy, not least because of the burgeoning cultural diversity of populations, which are much less homogenous than they were 100 years ago in the West, and which has also corresponded with classical music rescinding in importance for the vast majority of taxpayers. So as such, orchestras now have a responsibility towards more than just playing great music. They also need to address social issues and the changing landscapes in ways that might not have seemed important even 50 years ago. So Kelly, Ruthless Jabiru has always had an element of social activism attached to it. How has this facet of the ensemble allowed you to connect to 21st century audiences?
Well, yeah, you're right. The social activism side of Ruthless Jabiru, as I was saying earlier, the creating of a sort of meta program, a conceptual program, is really important part of my work. So some of the work we've created recent live performance we did was connection to the UK's first climate refugees in Northern Wales. Was the program that was called The Holy Presence Of, based around Julius Eastman's Holy Presence of Joan of Arc, and the program as a whole connected to this community in Northern Wales that's been driven out of their multi-generational home as a result of the land being flooded. So, I mean, that was just a story that spoke to me so deeply and so sort of unbelievable in our time, but it's really happening, and there's people over there in Wales that are experiencing this, and they're, you know, a sort of a multifaceted series of, you know, problems. Some previous work that we did a program centered around Bushra Türk's opera Silk Moth, which deals with the role of the mother and the emotional space of the mother in the world of honor crime, which is a really challenging topic. You know, these are not easy topics to deal with. I've done a project that was campaigning against oil sponsorship in the cultural industries. So that was the central piece of that program was Julia Woolf's Fuel, which, had the way that I like to work is with a central piece that sort of has a connection, a more direct connection to this, you know, campaigning concept, and then building a program outwards around that has these sonic connections to the piece. And so those are a couple of options. We also did the work that really kickstarted me on this necessity to connect to the world that we live in was Matthew Heinzen's Maralinga. I just thought, I mean, the story is so complicated. This space in South Australia that was designated by the British government a space for nuclear testing, and it really just decimated the land, the culture, the First Nations people that lived in the area. I mean, it's just a, you know, cataclysmic situation on so many levels. And it was embargoed for a long time. And then only, recently to when we did the project, which was about 10 or so years ago, came out of embargo. And so suddenly there was material available to read. And it's just an unbelievable story. But because it was buried for so long, it's one that not a lot of people are aware of. And so I thought, I can't play a piece responsibly called Maralinga without telling the story of Maralinga. So, and that project was a real eye-opener for me. We had the amazing Lara St. John playing violin, who is such an activist still to this day in so many capacities. And so she, you know, she speaks for herself on that, in that domain. But sort of the factors that came together for that project really made me think this is what it's all about. So it's important to connect with the communities because these topics are so different each time. As I said, sometimes they're challenging topics, and it's not always easy to project a dystopia and then get a great audience for it. So there are challenges to selling a project that is not a celebration of things. So that's definitely something I've come up against. The topics are so varied that it means that there's a very different story, a tone to the way we tell each project, a very different audience, and a different audience sector. I mean, it really, things really work on a project basis, not just on stage, but also off stage. So I think being the sort of operation that I am and we are, means that I can adapt to it, those projects in a much more nuanced way than if I had a full-time staff who had a, you know, given set of experiences. I can hire freelancers for specific roles on each project that have direct experience, lived experience with things like that. I like to try and work with specialists where I can. I think that's important. I'm learning about these topics through the piece of music that speaks to me. So I'm most definitely not a specialist on these issues. And it's the music that has woken up this fascination in me. And I hope that I can amplify that music and amplify that experience for then other people around me. But in doing so, also doing it on an intellectual level, also doing it on a sensory level. Yeah, my audiences are very varied also by virtue of being, I really like the way one Australian composer described us as Australia's offshore orchestra. I've now expanded that to include New Zealanders and people that identify as Australian in whatever way that is, but also working very definitively with British-based creatives and other cultural representations, whether or not they're based in the UK. It's Australasians on the ground in the UK, however they came to be there, working with people that are based in the UK, however they came to be there. But the reason I say that is that for a while I was trying to make sense of how to integrate the ticket buying audience in London specifically with our online audience, which are, you know, largely in Australia. In the early days of the organization, friends and family of the players, and trying to think of ways to make that connection. And what is our audience really? Is our audience the audience in the room, or are they the audience that are watching us and supporting us? And that also extends to our donors, our supporters. There is a lot of crossover. And again, it's projects that speak to people specifically. I know this happens to all organizations where there are things that specific donors, for example, have things that are important to them. And I see it in a very literal way played out in the fact that our audience that our orchestra has this sort of duality of connection with the UK and with Australia, New Zealand, and Australasia as a whole. Most recently, we've made an album with a British Iranian composer, a beautiful friend of mine, Susanne Lolivar. Her work is really based around this idea of diaspora in the Iranian diaspora, but also the concept of diaspora as a whole. And I think that spoke to me, this idea of having Australians being a community outside of Australia. Well, when I say Australians, I mean a cultural group having an identity in a sort of diasporic capacity as well as just in Australia.
Now, Bill, you mentioned a couple of times public service, and that seems to be a really key element of how you think and work. And then you mentioned also serving all demographics in the UK. Now, 40 years ago, now, I'm not suggesting that you're in the age bracket to have been dealing with these topics then, but as a general rule, 40 years ago, I doubt anyone in orchestral management was figuring out gender balances in programming and conducting, for instance. I mean, aside from Maren Allsop at the time, I'm not too sure there were too many women waving batons anywhere in the world. Now, with the BBC Proms, for instance, dedicated to gender parity in commissioning, recently announcing a 50-50 split of commissions between men and women, and women conductors finally being recognised, if still not in the definite minority, all of these being good examples of positive social change. How much of your work would you say is actually focused on positive social changes?
A lot of it. All of it, in fact. It's a culture we've created within the team, actually. And I really felt like we started to make some progress when I proposed a program and many of the more junior members of my team came back to me and said, Bill, that's a bit male and a bit white. And I went, touche, you're absolutely right. So the fact that they are calling me to task on what we put forward, and it was just me following a thematic idea without asking myself those questions, but the fact that those questions are now automatic is a real change. And I welcome that. I think audiences will be richer for it. Our musicians will be richer for it. And we will reach more audiences, because one thing I've actually learned is that this is not about ticking boxes. This is about representation. This is about telling a wider range of stories that tell the human experience. And the more wide our range of storytelling is, the more people we reach and we connect with. And that's real public service when you're actually trying to reach everybody. I'm not saying we're there. There's a lot of work to do in this area. I mean, I'm reminded, I was sort of inspired. This was quite a long time ago, but Yo-Yo Ma came to London and appeared on the Sunday morning breakfast show, news show, you know. And he played some solo Bach and it was, of course, beautiful. And then he was interviewed a bit. And the interviewer was talking about his humanitarian work and his campaigns and the various things that he's been fighting for. He's the front person for a number of different charities. And he basically said that he had spent most of his life fighting for a voice for the arts at the sort of table of where society makes its decisions and prioritizes everything that it does, whether that's governments or any other thing. And then he said, as he got a bit older, he suddenly realized, actually, we are the table. We don't need to be at the table. We actually are the table. We are the platform where people sit down and discuss these issues. And if we accept that mission, then Kelly, you spoke eloquently about how your work is informed by telling stories that bring the truth around social conditions that need to be told, and hopefully leads to change, or it leads to people talking about it. And that's kind of what I'm after as well. And I take that really quite seriously. And there's a slight dilemma in the sense that I'm working also for the BBC, and the BBC has core values around impartiality and trust, and its success as a world media organization depends on people trusting that they are getting the truth, or a balanced version of the truth. So what does that mean in the arts if we're talking about kind of exploring issues that are often controversial and, you know, hotly debated in many other ways? Where's the truth in that? And for me, that's a really tricky thing to interpret. But the core value that I see when I look at the website of the BBC, and it says one of the core parts of the BBC strategy at the moment is pursue truth with no agenda. And as a musician and as a creative, what I think that means is exactly what you're doing, Kelly, which is you find these truths, these stories that maybe people don't know about, and you find an eloquent way to connect people with that. And our method is music. Sometimes it's words in music, and sometimes it's visuals in music, but in other combinations of things. But at the core of it is a musical connection that is telling this story. So I'm looking for artists that are working in this realm. I did a project with Erilyn Wallen. We did a disability story around Teresa von Paradis, who was this virtuoso female pianist in Mozart's time, who studied with Salieri and was shortly after Mozart on the prodigy trail around the courts of Europe, but she was blind. And she was an amazing pianist, but she ended up, she came from an aristocratic family who forced all sorts of what we now see as cruel treatments for blindness, which of course we're all failed to, and she rebelled against it and had this amazing wild life with lovers in every city and eventually settled back in Vienna and opened a school for music for blind children. And it's this amazing story that spoke. So Erilyn wrote this opera, Grey Eye Theatre produced it. Jenny Seeley is a deaf opera director. And the entire cast was had some form of declared disability, whether it was neurodiversity or other kinds of, there were people in wheelchairs singing in the parts, people with visual impairment and all kinds of, the whole cast, the whole production. I had to find musicians who were willing to declare something around this. And we largely succeeded in that. And it toured around the country. And what happens, the final performances were in the South Bank Centre. And So if you put a major work on that has a disability story portrayed by disabled musicians and creatives, who's going to come? So they didn't have enough wheelchair spaces in South Bank Centre to accommodate the number of people. The concert was delayed 20 minutes starting because they had only one lift to lower the wheelchairs down, and they had to get them all in. It was a profound lesson. I mean, it was embarrassing, actually. And we had a conversation afterwards, an evaluation around it. It is a reminder that inclusion is kind of... If we're not actively making inclusion part of our mission in everything that we do, we are missing out on a huge chunk of society. And historically, we have done, which is why, you know, there's a poster in our office that is a quote that someone has made by some conductor decades ago who will remain nameless, who's just said, there just haven't been as many female composers. And of course, on the back of the poster is this massive long list of all these names, historic and living, etc., which is, we inherit all of these historical biases, and brick by brick, we knock them down, and we work on finding these stories. And I think more laterally, we did another project with the fabulous charity Streetwise Opera, and they had 10 commissions that were done in Nottingham, Manchester, and London by the cohort of people with lived experience of homelessness that was co-created, performed. And then what we did as the BBC was we got them orchestrated, or asked the composers to orchestrate them, put them on stage at the South Bank Centre, and performed with 60 people with perceived experience of homelessness on the stage and on Radio 3, and kind of Radio 3 people going, how are we going to record this? You've got 60 people moving around who've never been on a stage before. And I said, we will find a way, because this story is too important to tell. And it was one of the most profound performances I think I'd ever been involved in, because of the power of truth. And for the audience who came to support them, but also people who were just curious, who walk the streets of London and step over some of these people sometimes. It's a real eye-opening experience to be involved in that. And also for our musicians as well, this kind of opening of the world. We had some of these musicians come to rehearsal at Maida Vale Studios in West London, pushing a trolley with everything they owned, past security in the BBC building, you know. And it was just absolutely astonishing. And I sort of feel like, you know, this is public service. This is why we're here. And the more we can play Beethoven symphonies, and that's great, and we can tell, you know, and there's a power in music of any kind. But for the future of our art, this is the role that I think we really have to play.
That's beautiful. Thank you. On another social note, Bill, there's been conversation over the past years about the final night of the Proms, which might be the single most recognisable concert every year, perhaps alongside the Vienna Philharmonic's New Year's concert, complete with a hall filled with waving Union Jacks, the land of hope and glory, Jerusalem, and the national anthem. It's a celebration of patriotism that was extremely valid when the Proms were instigated and when these traditions were formed, but which has now veered towards criticism in recent times. How do you navigate the borders of tradition and innovation when it comes to topics like these? And is it annoying that perhaps you don't get as noticed or celebrated for the great innovative projects that you've just described with the Teresa von Paradis story? And it's more this discussion that becomes the main thing that the BBC Symphony Orchestra might be associated with.
Yeah, it's an ongoing thing, and it's a really tricky thing as well. And well, first of all, I would say that what you're describing is an issue. Whilst I will be at the table having a discussion around how things progress towards the future, it's a complicated situation in that decisions like this are not made by one person, and in a way, and this is not a cop out, but it will definitely be over my head where something like this actually takes place. But I think it's really also important to recognize that the BBC is this, and the BBC Symphony Orchestra actually, and the Proms themselves, create a space for innovation, for new work, for new talent, but also music for everyone is important as a guiding principle of the BBC Proms. And in that respect, all audiences have to be respected. And at the moment, some of those traditions are really important to a lot of people. You know, my mother-in-law stood up unprompted at the last bit of the last night of the proms and was singing at the top of her lungs. First time she'd ever been to the last night of the proms at the age of 86. And I just looked at that and I thought, oh my God, this really means something. She had tears in her eyes about it. Now, but the same thing is might mean something completely different to somebody else. And I'm very aware that Britain and other sort of first world countries have a lot to learn and to explore around the history of their own colonial pasts. And music plays a big part in that because it was part of it. It was culture and it was all part of it. But, at the moment, we stick with that, but we also innovate as well. So the last night of the proms will have new pieces and at some point, I'm sure things will evolve. The sequence that you're talking about actually was not there 100 years ago. It came about after the Second World War. It was, as you say, patriotic in that sense. And that was the vibe at the time. That was a necessary moment of celebration for the hardship that the country and all of the world actually had endured at the time. So it is entirely understandable how this came to be, but times do change. And so it didn't exist before then. So will it exist in the future? I don't know. I am sure of one thing. It will change.
And that's a fantastic point. I think that we often forget that music is for everyone and everyone is quite diverse in what they like. And there should be a place, I think, personally, for giving space for everyone to enjoy it. And that is probably the most difficult thing to do. Now, the proms themselves were the result of an extremely brilliant entrepreneurial effort by Sir Henry Wood and Co. When it comes to broadcasting and new programming, such as the late night proms, it has consistently been a platform for new ideas and innovations. Now, I find that we all understand that large institutions will learn from smaller institutions on the ground, as you mentioned earlier. And a question came to me whilst we were talking that if the BBC Symphony is learning from smaller organisations such as Ruthless Jabiru, what can the smaller organisations possibly learn from the BBC Symphony? Perhaps I'll throw this question to both of you. Perhaps Kelly first.
Well, my orchestra is by default made up of musicians from all these organisations. So there are Australian, New Zealanders in all the British-based orchestras that I'm aware of. And very much in rotation. So there's a lot of movement within between organizations, but you know, the players are around and they are representing their orchestras to some extent within my orchestra. And so I am tasked to create systems, especially in the rehearsal room, that sort of meet their expectations on a general basis. So I find that is sometimes challenging because, you know, different orchestras have different ways of working. I'm working with essentially a scratch group who are people that I know and have been connected to or have come to me by recommendation. I know, you know, it's a given that Australians that come to the UK, they have to be great musicians to exist in the UK and in Europe as a whole, or anywhere really. But in my experience, in the UK, they need to be great musicians to be able to have a career as a performing musician. And so I trust that people that are over here and are committed to the industry are going to be players of a certain caliber. And obviously everyone has different strengths that they bring. It works some well for me sometimes to have a very senior, someone who's been in an orchestra for 20, 30 years sitting with someone that's an early career musician, because they do feed off each other. I think that often those younger musicians bring a sort of enthusiasm or as you say, with the younger people that you're working with, Bill, like they're provocateurs to an extent. So they're questioning things, they're bringing new ideas, they're making points of relevance. So I think that definitely it's... We have this expectation that, I mean, and rightly so, the people that have been in the industry for longer have a greater body of experience. That goes without saying. That's time. That's the thing we call time. And that really goes without saying. And as I say, that is the way it is. So trying to then create a sort of build a project system. So whether that's a rehearsal plan, whether that's a sort of rehearsal tone, rehearsal pace is something that comes up often, especially when I'm working with such varied music. You mentioned Australian composers, but I'm actually working, I advocate for Australian composers, so that's a given in the context of being with a bunch of Australian New Zealanders. But I want to make a point of Australian composers being part of a global composer body. So Australian composers can exist and should exist in mainstream programming, basically. And so I really, something you said before about diversity practices. So for me, it does work to have a quota. I do try to have 50-50 non-male composers on per program, also 50-50 non-white composers. But I'm also working with trying to work with a mixture of ethnicities, a mixture of backgrounds, and by virtue that means that the music is varied. And sometimes it works better to connect by points of similarity, and sometimes it works better to work with contrast. So it's very project based. I'm sounding like a broken record here, but yeah, in essence, it's a case of trying to seeing the practices that exist in these larger organizations and then taking what works from those. And I'm looking at those myself as the one that's creating the plan, as it would appear, for the project. I'm looking at those systems from a bird's eye view. So, you know, knowing that's how it's, and through conversations with friends and colleagues. So what's working well in that organization? What do I want to take forward into this next project? So, and again, every project has a learning curve, and you always take something out of it. And, you know, after making self-producing work for 15, almost 20 years now, that I am astounded that there is always some huge revelation. I'm amazed that there's still crazy things that happen every project to learn from. I feel like I've seen it all, but that is definitely not the case.
Beautiful. And throwing to you, Bill, same question. I'm fascinated to hear what you think these smaller organizations can actually learn from larger institutions.
It's a similar thing that Kelly described, in the sense that, you know, there will be our musicians or musicians from other large London orchestras working with you, and they bring that with them when they come. They bring those experiences, they bring that sensibility, but they're also there because, as I was describing earlier around achieving musicians who want a balance, a wide variety of creative experiences now, we have a contract structure within our orchestra that does allow our musicians quite a fair amount of time and freedom to go and pursue other projects. And we see that as a really necessary part of our recruitment. We want musicians who are curious. We want musicians who have varied interests. They are really good at what they do in the big orchestra, but they also develop skills and creative ideas outside the orchestra, working in smaller groups and smaller ensembles, or being even solo careers, or chamber music, or recitals, or all variety of things. So in that respect, it's a symbiotic relationship, actually, having these different size ensembles that do different kinds of work on a different scale. Having said that, we're also not averse to reducing or breaking up the orchestra into smaller chunks and doing things. We did a Missy Mazzoli opera recently that had a very small band on stage concert performance. And we're resisting the need to put 98 musicians on the stage all the time. So that variety, that versatility is really healthy for musicians. So in that respect, I welcome that very much. What I love about the work that groups like Ruthless Jabra do is this kind of fearless, creative mission that you go on. And you know, it you are creating from zero, and that requires courage and a lot of determination. And in that respect, I want to make sure that we don't lose that. There's a danger that we could become too comfortable and automatic, and we have regular audiences, and they'll just turn up because we've got a brand and it works to a certain degree. And I don't think we can ever rest on that. We have to have some seeds of that sort of inspiration, of that creative genius at the start, you know, that connects with the audiences. So what I can learn from them is to retain that. It's a reminder that's kind of the core of being human, whether we were sitting around a fire creating instruments and singing songs for the first time millions of years ago or thousands of years ago. But I've heard some people describe a large symphony orchestra as one of the most sophisticated creations that humanity has ever managed. If you think about the complexity of it and the fact that you're working with so many individuals in such a highly sophisticated, measured and coordinated way, with and non-verbally, is quite astonishing, actually. And sometimes I pinch myself just thinking, wow, how is this actually happening, you know? It's a tradition. It's a long, long, many, many, many years of practice that is passed down and so on. But, you know, the fact that we're also willing to change it, I think, is really key. And that's what I would learn from organizations like Kelly's.
Kelly, what about your perception of your social reason for existence, which is a term I came up with that I can't really, I couldn't find a better way. So what I mean by that is, we've ascertained that you're definitely not in this industry to join the Forbes real-time billionaires list. But if you had to define it in 100 words or less, what is your motivation? What is the point of your work? And what keeps you waking up in the morning and going to work?
Well, I guess it's the emotional roller coaster that keeps me going. I mean, I wish that there weren't quite so many lows, but the ecstasy of the high, and you know, the meme with the, you know, this project is amazing, this project is terrible, I hate myself, oh, I'm a genius. Like, this is the constant story of my life and the life of every artist, I'm sure. But that platform to create that feeling in other people and for an audience. I'm working in a space of advocacy, of amplification. I want to take responsibility for being a force for change in our art form. You know, I think there is this heavy tradition that's associated with orchestras. And I think it's not always the way. There are options to be creative and to sort of push the envelope. And that's what I want to do. And I hope that I can create some change there. And this idea of relevance and currency, not the Forbes style, the currency and connection with the world that we live in and between people and between people and spaces and land and water and organisms, etc.
Bill, what about you? Same 100 word limitation. When it comes to your role as a custodian of an historic institution, whilst also yourself being a leader for the future, what are your personal motivations and what are you looking forward to?
I was working once with the visual artist in Scotland. This is a while back, and we were having a sort of creative meeting, and it got really heated, and they had the operations team saying, "You just can't. That's not going to work. You can't do that. It's not going to work." And the artist saying, "This has got to be. This is non-negotiable. I've got to have this." And they were going back and forth at each other, and I think I must have been sat with my head in my hands at some point in the meeting, and it kept going on, and I thought, I don't know how we're going to find a way through this. And the artist Douglas handed me a little piece of paper. And it said, "No pressure, no diamonds." And I love this. And I just, you know, basically, it was just saying, have courage. And, you know, we will find this is part of the process. This is the creative process. And it's hard. And if it needs to be hard, because all worthwhile things require sweat and effort and suffering in a way, you know. And so what gets me out of bed is that it is that the context, you called it the highs and the lows. you don't have the highs if you don't sweat through the lows. You know, you need the lows. The lows are there to give you perspective. The lows make the highs bigger. And so that's a really necessary part of it. So the highs are why I do it. The lows are the reminder that this is why we're doing it, is to actually, we have to put in the work. It is work. And you know, I've no plans to retire. I'm getting on in the later part of my career, but you know, I just love this process so much, and I love being involved with it, being surrounded by people who share that passion, and that for me, that's what keeps me going.
So now on to some quicker questions. This is the fun part, the fun segment. It's a little bit more lighthearted, so there's no right or wrong answers. Bill, first, a conductor comes to you and says they want to do the entire Bruckner cycle. How do you tell them no?
I wouldn't say no, but I would tell them, tell me how you're going to do this in a way that is different and engaging and brings a different audience to the whole thing. What are you pairing it with? How would you deliver this? Do we have to be in a concert hall? Can we be somewhere else? Can we play it in a church and have Bruckner organ works in between? Can we do something completely different with the whole thing? What does it mean? You know, and how can Bruckner mean something to people who've never heard of it before? So I would throw the challenge back.
Much better than my answer. My answer would have been, oh, sorry, I didn't see that email. Kelly, a musician with an Australian passport wants to join your ensemble, but they have a clear British accent and only spent 6 months in Australia as a two-year-old. What do you do?
Well, I think we're open to Australians with... Are they available for the gig?
Fantastic. Now, Bill, you spent around half your life, you mentioned, in the UK. So in that time, have you figured out what is better, bangers and mash or fish and chips?
For me, it's fish and chips. It's got to be.
That was the right answer. Kelly, after however many years you've been in London, 15, 16, you said it may be up to 20, have you been able to figure out what exactly a Yorkshire pudding is and why it takes up so much room on the plate?
It's like a pancake.
No one can explain it. Bill, if you had your time again and you explained how you got into music as a six-year-old playing violin, but if you had your time again, what professional athlete would you choose to be and why do you think you'd be a success in that role?
That's a tricky one. I'm influenced by the fact that all three of my sons are athletes. One's a professional decathlete, actually. So... as a father, I spent all this time at the track. So I started running because I was there. And so I just did it as well. So I don't know. I think I'd be an amazing middle distance runner, you know, the sort of Seb Coe of this world or something along those lines.
Well, for the audio only listeners, you can't see, but Bill would definitely be a fantastic middle distance runner, I think. Kelly, what character from a 90s sitcom would best define your personality? I have an answer, but I'm not telling you.
90s sitcom? Can't remember. Can't remember the 90s. I need time. Come back to me about that in 5 years.
Definite Rachel. Bill, what is the dream project you'd put together? If there was no limitation of budget or physical space or bureaucracy, what would you make?
Oh, what would I make? That's a really, really, really tricky one. I tell you what, I did the most amazing concert already, and this leads to the answer. We created a project based on Beano comics. So it was Dennis and Nasha unleashed at the orchestra. And I'd love to, you know, talk about 90s sitcoms. I'd love to do a Simpsons prom.
Sell out. Instant sell out. Kelly, favourite contemporary composer we don't know but we should know?
Susanne Lolliver. Ruthless Jabberoo's just made an album, so you can check it out at our website, ruthlessjabberoo.com. My website, kellylovelady.com.
It's a fantastic marketing. That was really good. Bill, what was a film or exhibition you've seen recently that we should know about?
Film. I actually watched something, this is going to sound, my wife kind of... fell over pretending to snore when I was trying to describe it to her. But I watched on Apple TV a whole series called Omnivore, which is like the history of food, and presented by this, I've forgotten his name, this chef who runs a double Michelin star restaurant in Copenhagen called, the restaurant's called Noma. famous restaurant, and he's created this thing, and like a lot of things on Apple, they don't have a huge amount of content, but everything they make is beautiful. It's really, really well done. It blew me away, the stories behind food and everything that he is talking about. Geopolitical, it's like a travel documentary for foodies. It was just astonishing. I'm going to have to watch it again now. I enjoyed it so much.
That's great. And final question for both of you. What are you both looking forward to the most at Classical next? Kelly?
I'm just looking forward to meeting people that are like-minded and after hearing their music, getting to know their personality a bit and seeing how those things inform each other and making some friends and getting inspired together.
Do you know, the thing that I've enjoyed the most is the conversations I didn't know I was going to have. This is one of them. But also just I've bumped into an Irish composer yesterday and ended up in this deep conversation around how do people experience music in a way, because she's non-hearing. And it was just the most fascinating thing. And I thought it was going to be a 2-minute, hello, how are you? But we ended up talking for like nearly an hour and it was just fascinating. So yeah, I don't know what's going to happen, but that's the one I'm looking forward to.
That's fantastic. Well, Bill Chandler, Kelly Lovelady, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for your time, your candor, your honesty. I hope you enjoy the rest of Berlin and Classical next. And please do bring your wonderful ensembles over here next time as well, please. Thank you so much.
Notenköpfe ist ein Podcast von Rondo, dem Klassik- und Jazz-Magazin. Informationen zum Magazin und weitere spannende Themen aus der Welt von Klassik und Jazz gibt es auf rondomagazin.de. Redaktion und Moderation Chris Lloyd. Ausführende Produzentin Verena von der Goltz. Aufnahme und Postproduktion Robert Niemeyer. Musik Markus Zierhofer. Kennt ihr schon den Podcast Der Klassikerklärer? Dort erwarten euch spannende Analysen und faszinierende Geschichten hinter den Meisterwerken der klassischen Musik. Wer Klassik wirklich verstehen will, ist beim Klassikerklärer Dario Szymanski bestens aufgehoben. Den Klassikerklärer findet ihr überall, wo es Podcasts gibt.